You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 29th of July 2021 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily is brought to you in association with Allianz.
UK COVID-19 cases appear to decline. Human Rights Watch accuses Israel of war crimes against Gaza and vice versa. And the best places to flee to should civilization collapse any time imminently. I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily in association with Allianz starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests Daniela Peled and Lance Price will be here to discuss all the day's big stories, and we'll have the latest episode of our series looking at the Olympics from an assortment of national angles. Today, New Zealand steps up to the shot put stop board, and try saying that six times quickly. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily in association with Allianz on Monocle 24. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I am joined today by Daniela Peled, the managing editor of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, also by Lance Price, political commentator and former director of communications at 10 Downing Street. Welcome both to the Monocle Daily. We will now do some light introductory banter, and as we have been in recent days, I have been trying to gauge the relative agogness of our guests vis-a-vis the Olympics. Daniela, as regular listeners will be aware, you are a keen sports fan, so I imagine you've barely been able to take your eyes off it.
Does this come under the category of sports ball or not? I'm confused.
Sports ball is played.
In that case, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Okay, you are familiar with the concept of the Olympic Games.
They have funny mascots and cardboard beds that the athletes are not allowed to have sex on.
Yes, if that's what you've taken away from the grand Olympic tradition, that's something, I guess. Basically, what I'm trying to do is steer as much of this program as I possibly can around to Jess Fox's fabulous gold medal run for Australia in the slalom canoe this morning, which I was pretty excited about. Lance, were you up early for that
one? I probably slept through it, I'm afraid. Yeah. But I'm sure it was a massive national triumph for which you and all your countrymen are rightly proud.
Okay, I feel thoroughly patronised in the old-school English fashion there, so thank you for that. We will hear more from our panel shortly, but we will start with a report from our bureau chief in Hong Kong, James Chambers, in which I detect the hand of this show's producer, Carlotta Ribello, who, as regular listeners will also be aware, is a massive census nerd. As James explains, Hong Kong's current census might end up being an inadvertent measure of an imminent exodus.
An army of volunteer field workers carrying red messenger bags is currently knocking on doors in Hong Kong and encouraging residents to complete the city's once-a-decade census. As harried households work their way through the form before next week's deadline, one question will hit home more than usual. Will you be in Hong Kong during the second half of this year? After a slow start, every one of us in this city of over 7 million people now seems to know a few friends preparing to leave. For me, it's a mixture of national security law exiles and some opportunists making the most of the relaxed immigration rules in the UK, Canada, and Australia. The anecdotal evidence of this began to emerge last month, just as the school holidays were approaching in Hong Kong and the COVID clouds were beginning to clear in the UK. Suddenly, there were long waiting lists for tuberculosis tests, a British requirement, and schools were going out of business because of a spike in student withdrawals. Then came the airport scenes last week. Pandemic hit departure halls, crowded again with teary-eyed family send-offs. All part of the ordinary ebb and flow of Hong Kong, according to the government. Flighty second passport holders will return, just like they did after the handover in 1997, once Hong Kong's economy takes off again. Boom times do indeed feel just around the corner. Auction house Christie's has just inked a 10-year lease on swanky new premises. But what has struck me is the type of people heading for the exit. And it's definitely not for financial reasons. Professionals and creatives are quitting comfortable jobs, filial duties, and blue skies. While the formerly timid and unadventurous are willing to risk their life savings on building an all-new life. Results from the census may help to put a figure on this latest exodus, but no amount of data collection will be able to count the true cost to those leaving Hong Kong or the city they leave behind.
Thanks to Monocle's James Chambers in Hong Kong. Well, let's turn to our panel, and we have learned by now not to tempt the fates where COVID-19 is concerned. To even say out loud the phrase, there has been a surprising recent decline in reported cases in the UK, and I for one sure hope this continues, is to acknowledge that somewhere a mummified monkey's paw is twitching. While case numbers did in fact tick upwards somewhat yesterday, that was the first increase in 8 days of decline and still represents a startling drop-off from circa this time last week. Lance, are you still allowing yourself to get excited by any potentially good news where COVID-19 is concerned?
I think so, yes. I mean, I think we are all desperate for good news, which is why we really do want this to be a genuine decline and not some statistical weirdness, or indeed, which it may be, the result of people not being tested because they don't want to find a positive result, younger people in particular. So my fear is it's a combination of those of us who are a little older in our years being properly vaccinated and younger people avoiding facing up to the possibility that they may have caught something because they have mild symptoms and they know they're not going to get seriously ill.
I mean, Daniela, we probably do have to bear in mind that almost by definition all case numbers throughout this thing have been underestimates, because obviously the only recorded cases are the ones for which there has been a positive test. And as Lance points out, lots of people don't get tested or don't know they've got it, etc., etc. Do you think, or are you allowing yourself to believe that this may be some kind of indication that it is burning itself out?
I am not so sure, and I hate to be the voice of doom here, but I shall be anyway. I mean, this isn't based on data particularly, but certainly anecdotally, I'm hearing so many reports of people who are deleting their app from their phones or avoiding places where they might get tested, test and trace might be, and whose children have got symptoms, for instance, but they're not getting them tested because they don't want to isolate. They don't want to miss work. Some people also don't want to miss going on holiday. And some people are actually just really sick of this. I just spent last week in isolation because of a close contact. And the number of people who said to me that they thought I was being a bit of a mug doing that and I should just be tested and I'm sure I would be fine was really quite extraordinary. And it really made me think as well how at the beginning of all this there was this blitz spirit idea that we were all in it together and we're all taking one for the team and we're helping to protect other people, and there is a limit to how long people can sustain that. And when other people are saying to you, oh, you're a mug for getting tested and you're a mug for spending the hottest week of the year in a sweltering flat with an annoyed nine-year-old then you don't do it. And I'm glad I did, because some of the people I was with actually tested positive. But I have a feeling that it's a lack of reported cases. And as well, the infections, people are getting milder symptoms because they do tend to be younger, and people who have been double vaccinated are getting ill again and are not as sick.
I mean, Lance, there is a question here, isn't there, of political messaging, which is very much your department. And this has always been something that's hung over this, is, you know, how you keep people doing the right thing the longer this, frankly, quite tedious crisis grinds on. Because at the start of any crisis, there is a certain amount of, I mean, excitement's the wrong word, but it galvanizes, there's a resolve, and there was all that stuff about, you know, we can pull together and we can beat this. But as Daniela points out, the numbers of people being told by their app that they've had a contact and they must isolate is extraordinary. It's nearly 700,000 in the week up to 21st of July. And this is the point at which we should acknowledge that this show is being produced by Carlotta Rebello from home, because she is one of the recently pinged herself. Do you get the sense that this government has just kind of given up where the messaging is concerned?
I think that they have had a problem all the way through with the confusion in their messaging, and it's been very, very difficult for people to follow. And I think in a sense, their latest message, which is pretty much it's personal responsibility. It's up to you to decide. And fair enough, the bus companies and the tube here in London are insisting that people wear a mask. But basically, the government is saying, look, you know, it's clearly not over, and it's really down to you to decide what to do. Bizarrely, that seems to be working. I mean, I came here on the Underground, and there seem to be more people wearing a mask now at a point where ministers are saying, well, you know, pretty much we're supposed to have had Freedom Day and we can do what we like. There seem to be more people obeying the bylaws on the London Underground than there were back in the first and second lockdowns, where there was a lot of reluctance to do it. It's almost as if the government says, OK, so you don't have to wear a mask anymore. So people are thinking, well, in that case, we will. You know, they're almost disregarding or doing whatever Boris Johnson doesn't tell them to do. And the problem, of course, then is that at the other end of the age scale, and perhaps there weren't that many young people on the tube as I was coming in to the programme, but at the other end of the age scale, where ministers are desperately, and I think quite rightly, urging them to go out and get vaccinated and even threatening them with sanctions if they don't, that they're shrugging their shoulders and saying, sorry, mate, not for us.
Daniela, that thought of COVID passports or vaccine passports or effective vaccine passports is one that is gathering momentum, not just in the UK, but elsewhere. Dominic Raab, the Foreign Secretary, has said that the government will not, quote, hold the country back because some people won't get their jabs. Is there something to be said for that, do you think? Sort of making it clear to people that, well, if you don't get vaccinated, then your options on a lot of fronts are about to become extremely curtailed.
There is something to be said for it, and I think it perhaps works better in some contexts, like in France, for instance, where society, if I can put it this way, tends to be quite rule-based, and people comply. I've been vaccinated myself, and I can't really quite understand why people wouldn't be doing this, but the fact is large sections of society are not willing to be vaccinated. And while a vaccine passport for travel is completely legitimate, I do worry that we will end up de facto excluding people from, I mean, nightclubs is one thing, but, you know, other services and other public spaces. And in general, I would imagine it is better to achieve this kind of result through messaging rather than through enforcement. But we haven't done very well when it comes to messaging. And I come across a hell of a lot of vaccine scepticism in my everyday life. So the way round that I'm not sure is to enforce vaccine passports. It's social pressure, I think, works much better. And maybe the chance of travelling, maybe the chance of actually going on holiday is quite compelling as well.
OK, well, let's move along to our next subject for consideration. This past May, not for the first time, Israel launched airstrikes against targets in Gaza in response to the firing of rockets from the walled-off strip into Israel. And this past week, not for the first time, Human Rights Watch has suggested that some of Israel's actions may have met the legal definition of war crimes, in particular three strikes which killed 62 Palestinians between them, which do not seem to have had much of a military imperative. The HRW report also suggested that Palestinian militant groups had a case to answer, having launched more than 4,000 unguided projectiles at civilian population centres. A fuller report on those is due in August. Daniela, first of all, to look at where this is coming from, i.e. Human Rights Watch, is it ever fair to say that Human Rights Watch might have a bit of a bee in its bonnet where Israel is concerned? Last week, it did attract quite a great deal of attention, I think quite rightly. HRW's executive director Ken Roth on Twitter went almost instantly from anti-Semitism is wrong to but Israel.
The issue is that Personality Society, Human Rights Watch, does a great deal of extremely valuable work. You know, I work across a couple of dozen countries in experiencing conflict and transition and so on, and we really respect and we use a lot of the data and reports and the expertise, and I don't think there's any particular reason to think it's any different when it comes to Israel. I think one of the confusing aspects is Human Rights Watch is reporting on legal definitions, on apartheid as a legal definition and on war crimes as a legal definition. But these are terms that are used very widely by people to refer to bad things that they don't like.
Mm.
But people getting killed is not necessarily a war crime, and political injustice is also not necessarily apartheid. Certainly in Israel, these conclusions are completely rejected, apart from a very small fringe of the far left in Israel. People would say we don't have apartheid because Arabs and Jews work together and so on, and they would say we can't have apartheid when we have black Jews and white Jews, etc., etc. So that the aspect of this as a legal definition of inequality is lost. And the same thing with war crimes. I spent a lot of time covering the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. And certainly when it came to the siege on Sarajevo, you can see how the different sides make similar accusations. The idea of human shields and the idea that the other side is actually planting bombs and planting weapons. And the arguments stay the same. I mean, if Israel was in a war crimes tribunal, it would be able to make a valid argument for why its military actions were not war crimes and why it was taking special measures and trying to minimise civilian casualties. The rather dark and sickly funny thing is that as Hamas have welcomed this report, I mean, there is really no doubt, they don't have a leg to stand on, that, as you said, sending projectiles into civilian areas is by definition a war crime. So, but that's asymmetric warfare. It doesn't really bother them.
Indeed it doesn't. And Lance, on that thought, is there a way for people trying to uphold some sort of standards amid conflict to maybe adjust language or adjust the terms of communication? Because as Daniela points out, when you start throwing around phrases like war crimes or apartheid, they are paradoxically actually quite easy for anybody accused of it to reject, because you can just say, well, no, we're not that, and here's why.
Yeah, I mean, I speak as somebody who worked for a prime minister who, after he left office, couldn't appear in public for the best part of 10 or 15 years without being accused of war crimes.
Indeed.
Tony Blair and Iraq. And I think the legalistic approach to whether something is a war crime or not is pretty well unhelpful. It's very unhelpful. But at the same time, I think people instinctively can recognise right and wrong when it comes to the use of violence in order to either defend yourself or to launch an attack. And, you know, it is absolutely abundantly clear. And yes, it is an asymmetric war, but it is absolutely abundantly clear that the firing of missiles into civilian areas is fundamentally wrong. Now, you can add to that it's also a war crime, but the important point is that it's fundamentally wrong. And I think it is equally true that the way in which Israel responds to that is very often excessive. Although they have some of the best military hardware in the world, which ought to enable them to target their attacks with great precision, it is a tragedy that such a very large number of civilians end up being killed almost every time that they do respond. And it is perfectly right and proper for people to draw attention to that and to draw attention to the imbalance in the number of civilian casualties on either side of the conflict.
Daniela, do reports by Human Rights Watch and similar reports by similar organisations have any impact at all on this conflict where it's actually happening? Are they taken seriously either within Israel or within the Palestinian territories beyond that obvious thing of people picking out the bits that broadly support their position and using them as a stick with which to beat their opponents?
Yeah, that is one of a very large part of their purpose. But I would say that, yes, they have a very important wider significance from two aspects. One is in terms of actually gathering testimony and presenting a history of what happened for any future justice processes. And I don't mean necessarily legal, but also transitional justice processes. The point is that wars end and conflicts pass. And so you do need to look beyond that. But I do think they have an impact as well. I mean, the likelihood of Israel or Hamas being at an international tribunal is vanishingly small. But certainly Israel is extremely concerned and extremely worried about it. In the same way that the economic boycott, divestment and sanctions campaign against Israel has zero economic impact, it's seen as a serious threat, an existential threat and a reputational threat. So I think it has an impact from that point of view. And also, since one of the principles of international law is complementarity, the idea that you have a chance of being hauled in front of an international tribunal if you can't prosecute crimes domestically. I've seen it in recent years, the Israeli army launching much more detailed investigations into events in Gaza and so on. I think that does make a difference. And although their immediate impact is perhaps not immediately recognisable, I think in the long term, they're very, very valuable and very important.
Daniela Pallett and Lance Price, thank you both for the moment. This is the Monocle Daily. We'll have more from our panel right after this.
Allianz is proud to partner the Monocle Daily on Monocle 24. Mental health is a major challenge facing society today. As a result of the pandemic and the added stress and isolation that have accompanied it, the number of people managing mental health concerns has grown significantly in the past year. Allianz believes that only by feeling strong and good about ourselves can we take on more in life and feel confident for what lies ahead. In an ever more complex world, our mental health is the very foundation for us to grow and feel more secure. Therefore, Allianz aims to be the peace of mind button, providing customers with resources, access, and support to help enhance their mental health. Behind you for what's ahead. Allianz. Confidence in tomorrow.
Welcome back to the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller. Still with me are our guests Daniela Pallett and Lance Price. Almost a decade after it was proposed, a Holocaust Memorial and Education Centre is to be built in London. Some of that time has been consumed by the competition to design it, won by a team led by Sir David Ajay, but there have also been objections to it. These, raised during a six-week inquiry into the project last year, were largely on the arguably somewhat prosaic basis that it might impinge on Victoria Tower Gardens in Westminster, including damage to trees. Lance, first of all, the memorial itself, having seen the plans, what do you think of it?
I think it's very appropriate. I think it's beautifully designed. The gardens in question, which are alongside the House of Lords end of the Houses of Parliament, is actually quite a large space. Mm-hmm. And this is tucked in at the end in a way that I think actually complements the rest of the park. It's a slightly underused venue anyway, that particular bit of ground. So I think it'll draw people in. And I think providing it's done with the kind of taste and is done wisely, I think it'll be a very, very good thing to have and a valuable contribution.
Daniela, those that have been in favour of this project have made it's the argument usually made in favour of them, that they are an educational, that they serve an educational function, that they operate as some kind of buttress against Holocaust denial, which weirdly is a thing that will not go away. Do you think that's the case?
Well, memorials in general, yes, but I think this is a pretty bad idea, and I don't know why they have to have it where it is. I mean, I have an idea. There are many more appropriate places I think you could host this. For instance, in the Imperial War Museum, which mm-hmm. has an excellent Holocaust gallery and is not very far away. There are numerous other spots, or the Wiener Archive, which is in Bloomsbury, which could be a venue for some sort of similar memorial. My horrible feeling is that David Cameron came up with this idea, and by having it so close to Parliament, it kind of is a sort of way of virtue signalling the idea that, well, Britain played a major role in, you know, ending or averting or solving the persecution of the Jews in the Second World War, which is actually not true. I mean, Britain took in 10,000 Jewish children under the Kinder transport, but only because they had financial guarantees. They didn't bring their families, who died, most of them. So I don't think this is a great place. I think, you know, obviously I think that Holocaust commemoration is very important, but parks are, saying that we need parks in public places doesn't mean that Holocaust commemoration is bad, but I don't see why this had to be there at all. Really not at all.
Just to follow that up, though, do you think they do, wherever they may happen to be, have any value in educating, let's be charitable and call them the uneducated? You probably saw that a couple of weeks ago, the Georgia Congresswoman and raging dingbat Marjorie Taylor Greene visited the Holocaust Museum in D.C. And tried to make a big thing of it about how she now understood that it perhaps wasn't the case to compare, telling unvaccinated people that they couldn't go into shopping centres with compelling European Jews to wear yellow stars.
Well, dingbats, as you put it, will forever be dingbats. But I think it is very important, and it's also not just about commemorating a particular historical event, but also promoting a message of tolerance and diversity. And it sends an important message not just to the Jewish community, but to minorities in general and the wider community. And I think Holocaust Memorial Day, which we have every January, is a fantastic idea, and especially because it's extended to survivors and victims of genocide in general. It's a very, very important moment of outreach. So yeah, I certainly don't think we should give up on this educational quest just because of some dingbats, but I also don't think that politicians should be allowed to exploit it quite as much as they do.
And Lance, is there a way, going back to your past and present as a political communicator, that politicians, who obviously have to get out in front of these things, otherwise they don't get built, but can perhaps position themselves slightly more sensitively while doing so?
Well, that is to imply that this wasn't sensitively done, and I'm not sure. I don't agree with Daniela about that. I mean, I think you could put it somewhere in the Imperial War Museum, but then you're kind of diluting it with all the rest of what is there. And the same would be the case anywhere else you might put it. Here it stands alone. That area around Parliament is the nearest we've got to the Mall in Washington, where there are big, important monuments to events, including the Holocaust. So I think he's absolutely right to have it there, and that we shouldn't tuck it away. But it has to tell the whole story. So it does have to tell the whole story of Britain's moral ambivalence at that time. And that's why I said earlier it had to be done with sensitivity. I don't know whether it will be. I sincerely hope it will be. But the opportunity is there to try to insist that it does.
Okay, well, let's move on to our final panel topic. And this is not quite the end of the show, but this is very much an "and finally" item in a couple of senses of that phrase. A report by Boffins, published in the journal Sustainability, has assessed that New Zealand may be the best place to survive the collapse of modern industrial civilization. And as an Australian, I am obliged at this point to express a modicum of mock surprise at the information that New Zealand has apparently undergone the establishment of modern industrial civilization. Other plausible refuges from any end of days Hobbesian free for all posited were Ireland, Iceland, Tasmania, and the United Kingdom. Daniela, are you surprised to see this very country on a list of places which it would be, plausible to start again a new life should everything fall to ruins around us?
Well, I am not, actually, and I've given this whole How to Survive the Apocalypse a great deal of thought. So it's one thing being on a isolated landmass with lots of natural resources, but imagine trying to light a fire by refracting the sun through your glasses lens. It's not so easy. So what I would do, as in many dystopian novels and films, I would head to a skyscraper, tall building, perhaps in inner city London, stock up, build some kind of new sort of self-contained society on the top 10 floors. I could go on at length. Perhaps I won't.
What is your plan for dealing with angry mobs at pitchforks, with pitchforks rather, that might gather around the base of your redoubt?
Throwing things at them.
Okay.
I've thought this through.
Yeah, you clearly you have thought this through. Lance, do you have a preferred choice of destination in the event of the complete abnegation of the social contract.
Yeah, I'm afraid, Daniel, I've been stuck at the top of a tower block for the remaining days of my life. Sounds worse than actually giving myself over to the zombies and the four horsemen of the apocalypse. So I would go for one of the more rural destinations. I mean, New Zealand would be a lovely place to confront the end of the world, because you'd be surrounded by such nice people and also very close to some other nice people on a much larger continent across the way.
Well, exactly. Australia does not make the list apart from Tasmania, I'm somewhat bewildered by.
Yeah, I'd go for New Zealand over Tasmania, but I think top of the list I would go for Iceland, because in Iceland you'd be guaranteed a hot bath any day of the week because they have all the thermal power there. And you've got lots of high mountains that you could go up if the seas were rising. I'm not quite sure what apocalypse it is that we're worried about.
Just general
apocalypses, yeah. But it could involve rising seas, because that is certainly one end of the world scenario that we have to bear.
You're not
in
perturbed by the fact that Iceland is basically a literal volcano?
No, not particularly. I mean, if you're going to go, you may as well go in a massive volcanic eruption. I mean, and surrounded by beautiful, beautiful countryside, and be able to have a warm bath. I mean, it's just a no-brainer as far as I can see.
I mean, I've been to Iceland many times. It's lovely and everything. It's very odd.
Yeah, it's full of slightly strange people, but I don't mind being surrounded by quirky people.
Would you have any objection to a life on a diet substantially comprised of that weird rotted shark and puffin meat?
No, the rotted shark is absolutely vile, I have to tell you. They have very, very strong liqueurs that you take with
them. They do. To be honest, I'm not sure that the Icelanders actually eat the rotted shark. I think that's like...
They just give it to us.
I think that's like what the Scots tell people about haggis hunting, or what Australians tell
absolutely
people about
right.
drop bears.
You get to see the Northern Lights as well, so you may as well die, in a hot bath with the Northern Lights, surrounded by beautiful scenery and a few weird people, but that's okay.
Daniela, is Lance tempting you downstairs yet?
No, not at all, because I see myself raiding Lidl, M&S, Waitrose, all the luxury brands and some of the bargain basements, and the Northern Lights will be, the whole of London will be on fire anyway, so the Northern Lights could be that.
Okay, we should just make it clear that Monocle 24 does not advocate the looting of supermarkets. Address all complaints to Daniela Pelled individually. Daniela Pelled and Lance Price, thank you both for joining us. Actually, finally, on today's show, it is time for today's episode of our series on the Olympic Games. For the duration of the Olympics, as you will know by now, some of Monocle's riotously international staff have been looking back to their home nation's favourite Olympic moment. And today it is the turn of New Zealand, specifically of Monocle's and New Zealand's David Stevens, who looks at Valerie Adams' absolute domination of women's shot put for over a decade.
It's fairly well understood in New Zealand that when it comes to sports, the nation is either wholly dominant or virtually invisible. Does New Zealand even have a national football team? Is a real question I've been asked since living in the UK. In case you're wondering, we do. They're called the All Whites and they're, well, pretty bad. Like 122nd in the world bad.
Mexico qualify for Brazil 2014. Winning 4-2 here in New Zealand after a 5-1 victory at the Azteca. The managers...
Their chromatic opposites, however, the world-famous All Blacks, are one of the most dominant teams not just in rugby, but in all of world sports.
The All Blacks, still the kings of world rugby. Is this the greatest ever era, even for New Zealand?
When making a list of New Zealanders who dominate the sporting world, though, there's one woman who I would expect to be thrown up near the top, the shot-putting juggernaut, Dame Valerie Adams.
And to defend the Commonwealth title, the Queen of the Shot Put continues her unbeaten run.
Adams started young, with her first international gold coming at 16 years old at the 2001 World Youth Championships, following that up a year later with a silver at the Commonwealth Games.
1.93 metres tall, and potentially the youngest Commonwealth Games champion, possibly one of the youngest track and field champions ever, at just 17. What a prospect she is.
After a few years adjusting to the highest level of competition, and a seventh place finish at her first Olympics in 2004 while still recovering from an appendectomy she had just weeks before, Adams began an astounding gilded run at the top of her sport on March 22, 2006, with a gold at the Melbourne Commonwealth Games. She competed in her next 14 major competitions without losing, including two further Commonwealth golds, two Olympic golds, and 10 wins at various world championships. She set up shop at the top of the podium, where she remained until March 19, 2016, almost 10 years to the day from her 2006 Commonwealth gold, when she finished third at the Portland World Indoor Championships.
She's not going to take a fourth world indoor gold. She has three. The bronze medal at the moment. The bronze medal goes to Valerie Adams, 1925.
Adams comes from clearly athletic stock. Born to a Tongan mother and an English father in Rotorua, New Zealand, she is one of 18 siblings that all average over 6 feet tall. Her younger brother Stephen is a near household name to American sports fans, playing in the National Basketball League and making good use of his inherited height advantage.
Job by Stephen Adams, 15 offensive rebounds so far for the Thunder as well.
Oh, yeah. Yes!
Wow! Did somebody drop him down out of the ceiling?
Their younger sister, Lisa Adams, is also chasing the Olympic dream as an aspiring Paralympic shot putter and discus thrower. One of the more notable and undoubtedly cruel Olympic moments in Dame Valerie's career came at the 2012 London Olympics, as she attempted to defend her previous Olympic gold from the 2008 Beijing Games. After taking the lead in her first throw, Adams was overtaken by the Belarusian Nadzaya Ostapchuk, who went on to win the competition, with Adams taking silver.
So Ostapchuk goes into the circle to have a last put, and she is the Olympic champion, the defending champion.
A week later, and well after the medals were handed out, the IOC announced that the assumed gold medalist had tested positive for performance-enhancing substances both before and after her win. Ostapchuk was formally expelled from the games, and her victory was removed from the records. But while Adams was eventually awarded the gold she deserved, she was denied that glorious moment to stand atop the podium and hear her national anthem played to a packed stadium.
Ladies and gentlemen, please stand for the national anthem of New Zealand.
What's most astounding, though, is that this wasn't the first time Adams had had to climb the results sheet days after the competition's final throw. It was also, almost unbelievably, the third time that this particular Belarusian athlete had seemed to outthrow Adams, only to be later disqualified. Adams wasn't quite able to make it three consecutive golds at the Rio 2016 Games, although she did still manage silver, but will have a chance for a medal at her fifth Games this summer in Tokyo. Now down to fourth equal on the world rankings, she's not quite the terrifying figure she once was, but New Zealand will surely yet again have sharp focus on the shot put circle, in the hope that our athletics golden child can upset the odds and do it all over again. For Monocle 24 and for all of New Zealand, I'm David Stevens.
Thank you, David. That is all for this edition of The Daily. A big thanks to our panellists today, Daniela Pellet and Lance Price, also to James Chambers in Hong Kong. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Ribello and researched by Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. Our sound engineers were David Stevens and Chris Ablakwa. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily returns at the same time tomorrow. Thanks very much for listening.